the Einsatzgruppen. The remaining part of the extermination legend is that the Einsatzgruppen exterminated Russian Jews in gas mobiles and by mass shootings. This is the only part of the legend which contains a particle of truth. At the time of the German invasion of Russia in June 1941, there was a Führer order declaring, in anticipation of an identical Soviet policy, that the war with Russia was not to be fought on the basis of the traditional rules of warfare. Necessary measures were to be taken to counter partisan activity, and Himmler was given the power to, quote, act independently upon his own responsibility, unquote. Everybody knew that meant executions of partisans and persons collaborating with partisans. The dirty task was assigned to four Einsatzgruppen of the SD, which had a total strength of about 3,000 men, meaning of the order of 500 to 1,000 men per group. Knowledgeable authorities, incidentally, have accepted that such anti-partisan operations were necessary in the Russian theater, where the enemy had no regard for the rules. We have had occasion to note in several instances that Jews did, in fact, pose a security menace to the German rear in the war. The Red Cross excerpt makes this quite clear. The task of the Einsatzgruppen was to deal with such dangers by all necessary means, so we need not be told much more to surmise that the Einsatzgruppen must have shot many Jews, although we do not know whether many means 5,000, 25,000 or 100,000. Naturally, many non-Jews were also executed. However, the claim goes beyond this, and asserts a dual role for the Einsatzgruppen. They were charged not only with keeping the partisan problem under control, but also with exterminating all Jews, and Gypsies. Common sense alone should reject the notion that the Einsatzgruppen, which had a total strength of about 3,000 men, as a matter of general policy, spent their time and effort pursuing objectives unrelated to military considerations. We are again offered a fact for dual interpretation. The story is that there was no written order to exterminate the Jews, but that the Einsatzgruppen commanders got their orders orally and at different times. Ohlendorf commanded Group D in southern Russia, and he got his orders orally from Streckenbach in June 1941. Rosch of Group C, operating to the immediate north of Ohlendorf, did not get his orders until August 1941. Groups A and B operated around the Baltic states and to the southeast of the Baltic states, respectively, and were commanded by Stoliker and Nebba, respectively. The main evidence for exterminations is a huge amount of documentary evidence which is simply funny. There is the celebrated document 501 PS, which the Russians possessed at a show trial that they staged in December 1943. One part is said to be a letter to Rauf in Berlin, written by an SS second lieutenant Becker. This is apparently the only document claimed to be signed by Becker, who is said to have been dead at the time of the IMT trial. It reads, quote, the overhauling of the wagon by Groups D and C is finished. While the wagon in the first series can also be put into action if the weather is not too bad, the wagon of the second series, sourer, stop completely in rainy weather. I ordered the wagon of Group D to be camouflaged as house trailers. The driver presses the accelerator to the fullest extent. By doing that, the persons to be executed suffer death from suffocation and not death by dozing off as was planned, unquote. The text of the document is as spurious sounding as one should expect the text of such a document to be. It was allegedly written by an obscure second lieutenant, and fortuitously fell into the hands of the Russians in 1943. Alexander I. Solzhenitsyn, in the Gulag Archipelago, mentions the case of the Bavarian Jupp Aschenbrunner, whom the Russians persuaded to sign a similar declaration that he had worked on wartime gas vans, but Aschenbrunner was later able to prove that, at the time he had supposedly been working on the vans, he was actually in Munich, studying to become an electric welder. The most frequently cited evidence is a collection of documents purporting to be daily and other reports of the Einsatzgruppen to Himmler and Heydrich, for the period June 1941 to May 1942. Document numbers are 180 liter, said to be a report of Stoliker found in Himmler's files, 2273 PS, said to be another Stoliker report on actions up to January 31, 1942, quote, captured by Russians in Riga, unquote. Stoliker was killed in March 1942, 119 USSR, and many others, too numerous to list, most having numbers around NO3000. Beside telling of regular anti-partisan activities, the reports tell of individual actions of mass executions of Jews, with numbers of victims usually running in the thousands. It is indicated, in most cases, that many copies, sometimes as many as 100, were distributed. They were mimeographed, and signatures are most rare and, when they occur, appear on non-incriminating pages. Document NO3159, for example, has a signature of an R.R. Strauch, but only on a covering page giving the locations of various units of the Einsatzgruppen. There is also NO 1128, allegedly from Himmler to Hitler, reporting, Among other things, the execution of 363,211 Russian Jews in August to November 1942. This claim occurs on page 4 of NO 1128, while initials said to be Himmler's occur on the irrelevant page 1. Moreover, Himmler's initials were easy to forge, three vertical lines with a horizontal line drawn through them. In connection with these matters, the reader should be informed that, when examining printed reproductions of documents in the IMT and NMT volumes, a handwritten signature not be assumed, unless it is specifically stated that the signature is handwritten. Sign generally means only a typewritten signature. Document 180 liters, for example, is reproduced in German in the IMT volumes, and excerpts in English are reproduced in the NMT volumes. In both cases, signatures are indicated, but the actual document merely has gezeichnet Dr. Stahlecker, signed Dr. Stahlecker, typewritten in two places. There are two documents said to have been authored by Heinrich Lohse, Reichskommissar for the Ostland, who was also the person to whom Wetzel's Brack remedy letter was addressed, see page 231 of the print edition of this book. One of the documents deals with Sonderbehandlung and was alluded to in chapter 4, page 159. Like Wetzel, Lohse was never called as a witness at Nuremberg. Unlike Wetzel, however, Lohse stood trial before a German court, and was sentenced in 1948 to 10 years imprisonment. However, he was released in 1951 on grounds of ill health, and awarded a pension, which was shortly later disallowed on account of public protest. As for the comments attributed to him, Reitlinger remarks that they, quote, saved him from the Allied military courts and perhaps the gallows, unquote, for, while they speak of atrocities, they are so worded as to put the author of the documents in opposition to the crimes. The document dealing with Sonderbehandlung is a letter from Lohse to Rosenberg dated June 18, 1943. The actual document, 135R, seems to be claimed to be an unsigned carbon copy of the correspondence, found in SS files. The relevant passage reads, quote, that Jews are Sonderbehandelt requires no further discussion. But that things proceed as is explained in the report of the Generalkommissar of June 1, 1943, seems scarcely believable. What is Cotton compared to that? Unquote. Three unsigned reports supposedly received from the Generalkommissar, Wilhelm Kuba, Generalkommissar for White Russia, are attached to the document. The second Lohse document is 3,663 PS, and is one of several documents bearing the major irregularity of having been processed by the YIVO, Yiddish Scientific Institute, of New York, before being submitted as Nuremberg trial documents. There are about 70 such documents said to have been found in the Rosenberg Ministry in September 1945 by Sergeant Psycho Fridman of the U.S. 82nd Airborne Division. Fridman, however, was a staff member of the YIVO both before and after his service in the Army. Indeed, the YIVO was so active in producing documents supposedly found in the Rosenberg Ministry, that it may very well have some enlightening information on the origins of the supposed text of Himmler's Posen speech. The first part of the document is written on the stationery of the Ministry. It is a letter to Lohse, dated October 31, 1941, with a typewritten signature by Drive Leibbrandt, and an illegible handwritten endorsement by somebody else. It reads, quote, the RSHA has complained that the Reichskommissar for the Ostland has forbidden executions of Jews in Libau. I request a report in regard to this matter by return mail, unquote. The second part of the document is the reply, handwritten on the reverse side of the first part, supposedly in the hand of Trompadoc and initialed by Lohse, with a letter L about 1.5 inches high. It reads, quote, I have forbidden the wild executions of Jews in Libau because they were not justifiable in the manner in which they were carried out. I should like to be informed whether your inquiry of 31st of October is to be regarded as a directive to liquidate all Jews in the East? Shall this take place without regard to age and sex and economic interests, of the Wehrmacht, for instance, in specialists in the armament industry? Of course, the cleansing of the East of Jews is a necessary task. Its solution, however, must be harmonized with the necessities of war production. So far, I have not been able to find such a directive either in the regulations regarding the Jewish question in the Brown Portfolio or in other decrees, unquote. Obviously, Lohse could not have any conceivable reason to contest the authenticity of these documents because, though they suggest exterminations, they emphatically excuse him. Another document from the YIVO is 3,428 PS, supposedly a letter from Kuba to Lohse, reporting shipments of German, Polish and other Jews to the Minsk area, and the liquidation of some of them. From the mimeograph summary examined, it is not clear whether or not the document is supposed to have a handwritten signature. Wilhelm Kuba was assassinated in September 1943. Other documents that are relevant are numbered 3,660 PS through 3,669 PS, excepting 3,663 PS. The documents are attributed to various people, for example Kuba and Gaveka, and in every case the descriptive material accompanying the document specifies that the location of the original is unknown, and that only a photostat is available. With only a couple of exceptions, there are no handwritten signatures. Even Reitlinger seems puzzled by the existence of these reports and other documents, because he remarks, quote, "It is not easy to see why the murderers left such an abundant testimony behind them, for in spite of their wide circulation list, Noblex, the Gestapo official who edited the reports seem to have been designed primarily to appeal to Himmler and Heydrich. Thus, in addition to much juggling with the daily death bills in order to produce an impressive total, there are some rather amateur essays in political intelligence work," unquote. It is the amateur essays that convince one of forgery here. The contents of these reports are ridiculous in the selection of things reported. To give a few examples from excerpts reproduced in NMT Volume 4, quote, "The tactics, to put terror against terror, succeeded marvelously. From fear of reprisals, the peasants came a distance of 20 kilometers and more to the headquarters of the Teilkommando of Einsatzgruppe A on foot or on horseback, in order to bring news about partisans, news which was accurate in most of the cases. In this connection, a single case may be mentioned, which proves the correctness of the principle terror against terror. In the village of Yanova, it was ascertained on the basis of a report made by the peasant Yemelyanov, and after further interrogations and other searches, that partisans had been fed in the house of Anna Prokofieva. The house was burned down on August 8, 1941 at about 21 hours, and its inhabitants arrested. Shortly after midnight, partisans set light to the house of the informer Yemelyanov. A detachment sent to Jaknowa on the following day ascertained that the peasant woman Osipova had told the partisans that Yemelyanov had made the report, which had caused our action. Osipova was shot, and her house burned down. Further, two 16-year-old youths from the village were shot because, according to their own confession, they had rendered information and courier service to the partisans. Several Jews who had not been searched thoroughly enough by the Lithuanian guards drew knives and pistols, and uttering cries like "Long live Stalin!" and "Down with Hitler!" they rushed upon the police force, of whom seven were wounded. Resistance was broken at once. After 150 Jews had been shot on the spot, the transport of the remaining Jews to the place of execution was carried through without further incident. In the course of the greater action against Jews, 3,412 Jews were shot in Minsk, 302 in Vylika, and 2,007 in Baranovichi. The population welcomed these actions, when they found out, while inspecting the apartments, that the Jews still had great stocks of food at their disposal, whereas their own supplies were extremely low. Jews appear again and again, especially in the sphere of the black market. In the Minsk canteen, which serves the population with food, and is operated by the city administration, two Jews had committed large-scale embezzlements and briberies. The food, which was obtained in this way, was sold on the black market, unquote. It is not difficult to see why these documents exist. Without them, the authors of the lie would have no evidence for their claims except testimony. We have seen that with Auschwitz there was an abundance of material facts to work with, and whose meanings could be distorted. Shipments of Jews to Auschwitz, many of whom did not return to their original homes, large shipments of a source of hydrogen cyanide gas, elaborate cremation facilities, selections, the stench. The situation with the Einsatzgruppen was different. There was only one fact, the executions. Standing alone, this fact does not appear impressive as evidence, and this consideration was no doubt the motivation for manufacturing these documents on such a large scale. This is in contrast to the Auschwitz hoax, for which forgery of documents is not nearly so prominent, and where the forgeries were accomplished with more care. With Auschwitz, we are dealing with a lie manufactured by Washington, but with the Einsatzgruppen, we are dealing with one manufactured by Moscow, and the hand is correspondingly heavier. It is worth mentioning that the quote-unquote gas mobiles were not charged in Soviet propaganda until the middle of the war. Massacres of Jews were claimed, of course, early in the development of the propaganda, and the New York Times story of April 6, 1942, chapter 3, page 100, is an example. The massacres are not claimed to have taken place via gas mobiles. A contemporary Soviet propaganda production was the book, We Shall Not Forgive. Foreign Languages Publishing House, Moscow, 1942. The book opens with a summary, presented by Molotov on April 27, 1942, of the crimes that the Germans had supposedly committed in their invasion of Russia. The remainder of the book elaborates the charges with commentaries and photographs, with quite a few obvious phonies in the collection. Since the Germans are charged with virtually every crime imaginable, they are naturally charged with pogroms and massacres of Jews, but gas mobiles do not appear in the charges. As far as we can see, the first claims of gas mobile exterminations on Russian territory, as distinct from claims of gas mobiles at Chełmno in Poland, came in July 1943, during a Soviet trial of 11 Russians accused of having collaborated with the Germans at Krasnodar. This suggests that the Russian claims may have been inspired by the gas chamber propaganda that had started in the West late in 1942. In any case, the late appearance of the gas mobile charges, just as in the case of the Auschwitz propaganda, is further proof that the charges are inventions. There is also a certain amount of testimony that should be mentioned. At the risk of belaboring a perfectly simple point, let us again observe what had been pointed out here from many different angles, that a witness testifies in court to the truth of X, under conditions where the court is already committed to the truth of X, is historical evidence of absolutely nothing. The most frequently referred to testimony is that of Ohlendorf, an SS lieutenant general and an economist, who had had some differences with Himmler, and consequently found himself assigned to command Group D for 1 year, summer 1941 to summer 1942, in southern Russia. Ohlendorf was the most literate of the people involved in this matter. At the IMT, when other people were on trial, Ohlendorf had appeared as a prosecution witness, and had testified in agreement with the extermination claims. He testified that he had received oral orders to add extermination of Jews to his activities, that gas mobiles were used to exterminate women and children, that document 501-PS was authentic, Becker's letter, and that the Wehrmacht was implicated in these things. Thus, this charge regarding the Einsatzgruppen was part of the IMT judgment, which even stated that Ohlendorf exterminated Jews with Group D. As we have seen, these statements in the judgment constituted, quote, proof of the fact stated, unquote, when Ohlendorf, no doubt contrary to his expectations, was put on trial as the principal defendant in Case 9. In view of the legal constraints involved here, nobody's position could have been more hopeless than Ohlendorf's at his own trial. Ohlendorf's NMT testimony was simply contradictory. He was stuck with his IMT testimony, which the prosecution was mindful of holding him to, but he tried to squirm out anyway, and the result was a story having no coherency whatever. He retracted his earlier statement that there had been specific extermination orders, but under cross-examination, he said that he was killing all Jews and gypsies anyway, but that this was just an anti-partisan operation, not part of a program to exterminate all Jews and gypsies on racial or religious grounds. However, the total number of persons of all categories executed by Group D during his year in Russia was only 40,000, and not the 90,000 that he had testified to at the IMT, and which the NMT prosecutor attempted to hold him to. Either figure, of course, especially the former, makes some sense, if the executions were only in connection with anti-partisan measure, but make no sense at all, if one is supposed to be executing all Jews and gypsies at the same time, including women and children. Ohlendorf's NMT testimony is thus hopelessly contradictory, as it was bound to be in the circumstances in which he found himself. One should note, however, that Ohlendorf did not testify to the reality of any executions, which his court was not formally committed, a priori, to accepting, as factual anyway. The only part of Ohlendorf's testimony that may be of value is his attack on the Einsatzgruppen reports as quote-unquote edited. Ohlendorf's testimony contrasts with that of Hinch, an SS lieutenant colonel who was in command of a Sonderkommando in Group C for about 7 weeks. The fact that Hinch had not testified previously when others were on trial, and the fact that his lower rank made the a priori constraints on Case 9 of lesser effect in his case, gave him a freedom that Ohlendorf did not enjoy. He testified that absolutely nobody, in giving him his orders, had ever mentioned Jews as such, in connection with executive activities of the Einsatzgruppen, and that his Sonderkommando had not, as a matter of fact, had a policy of executing Jews as such. He estimated that his Sonderkommando executed about 60 people during his period of service. All of these claims were completely in conflict with what are said to be the reports of the Einsatzgruppen, as the court pointed out in detail in the judgment, concluding that in connection with Hinch, quote, one can only dismiss as fantastic the declaration of the defendant that his predecessor, who had admittedly executed thousands of Jews under the Führer order, and whose program Hinch was to continue, said nothing to Hinch about that program. And when Hinch boldly uttered that the first time he ever had any inkling of the Führer order, was when he arrived in Nuremberg 6 years later, he entered into the category of incredulousness which defies characterization. Unquote. Ohlendorf and Hinch were both sentenced to hang. Ohlendorf's sentence was carried out in 1951, but Hinch's sentence was commuted to 15 years. Presumably, he was out sometime during the 50s. Of course, the basic plea of all defendants in Case 9 as well as in almost all other cases was that, whatever they did, was done in obedience to orders, that could be disobeyed only under circumstances, that would have resulted in the execution of the disobedient person. Incidentally, in my opinion this is a perfectly valid defense, and it may have been this consideration that played a role in whatever inducements were offered to Germans to become prosecution witnesses at the IMT trial. It did not imply his guilt or, at least, it logically did not, if it was done in obedience to orders. In fact, this was the case in the German military law that the German witnesses were familiar with. Disobedience of even an illegal order was a serious and punishable offense. People such as Huss and Ohlendorf had, no doubt, reasoned that their testimony at the IMT had incriminated them only in the sense of perjury, an offense that they knew the Allied tribunals would never charge them with. Ohlendorf's attempts to ingratiate himself with the US prosecutors did not, moreover, end with the IMT, for he was also used, after his own trial and while he was under sentence of death, as a prosecution witness against Wehrmacht generals in Case 12. Personal guilt, obviously, is not involved, if the actions demanded or suggested by the accusers would have led to the clearly inevitable death of the accused. I suspect that every accuser of the Einsatzgruppen would have obeyed orders to participate in the air raids on Hamburg, Dresden, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, none of which, incidentally, had credible military motivations. However, I do not want to create an impression that I am denying that the Einsatzgruppen executed apparent civilians, including women and children, in connection with their activities in Russia. All experience with anti-partisan warfare, whether conducted by the British, the French or the Americans, suggests, quite independently of the tainted, to put it mildly, evidence of the trials at Nuremberg, that such things happened. In the Vietnam War, Americans did much of this with napalm, and then made a big fuss over the fact that one obscure lieutenant had been caught doing it with bullets. Neither am I trying to create an impression that, actually, everybody is very brutal, but a thorough discussion of the problems involved would carry us far afield, so it will not be attempted, only the essentials can be outlined here. It is an unhappy fact that partisan, irregular or guerrilla warfare, together with the measures taken to suppress such operations, is not only the dirtiest business in existence but has also been a regular feature of 20th century history. It is dirty business even when the two sides are highly civilized and culturally similar. A good example is the British campaign against the Irish Rebellion of 1916-1921, where both sides acted with remarkable brutality. If one adds to the fact of guerrilla warfare that at least one side is drawn from a primitive, uncivilized, or semi-civilized population, then one has a situation that it is most difficult for an ordinary civilized person to grasp, if he has no direct experience of it. It is too easy for us, sitting in the warmth of our living rooms, to generate moral indignation over operations, which involve the killing of, quote, apparent civilians, including women and children, unquote. The typical West European or American has lived in a culture, in which certain standards of charity, kindness and honor have been taken for granted, and it is difficult for him to understand that certain fundamental assumptions about other people would not hold in a context such as guerrilla warfare in Asia or Russia. The viciousness involved exceeds the imagination. To give just one example drawn from our Vietnam experience, what do you do if a child, despite signaled warnings to stay away, is obstinately approaching you asking for food or candy, and it is known that there is a good chance that there is a grenade attached to him? Of course, many needless brutalities always occur in such circumstances, but one should attempt to understand the situation. What I am denying with respect to the Einsatzgruppen is that one can give any credence to the story told by the trial's evidence, which, while it is somewhat variable on some points, has the basic feature of asserting that the Einsatzgruppen, which had a total strength of about 3,000 for the anti-partisan operations for all of occupied Russia, regularly and as a matter of policy, pursued a second set of objectives not related to military considerations, those objectives, exterminations, requiring substantial means for their attainment. We can, especially in view of the obvious forgery and perjury which has been practiced in connection with making this claim, dismiss all of that as propaganda. What did in fact happen, can only, most probably, be approximately grasped on account of the scantiness of reliable evidence. Unfortunately, it would appear that the events in Russia will never be established with exactitude, and that these episodes will remain partially in darkness.